All right, let's dive in. Signs of abuse. I mean, they're rarely this obvious. Rarely is someone, and we're back, rarely is someone going to walk into church with a black eye and say, wow, this person's being abused. If only it were that easy. We know this is a stereotype. Most batters have enough sense to not injure someone where it's visible. Some are clueless. Injuries around the wrists, grabbing and pinning, upper arms, neck and face.
And the head.
And the head, yeah. Batters love the head. You hide it under hair. One program that North Carolina has is educating hairdressers about domestic violence and what to look for. Because, one, they're the only ones that see this area up close. And, two, a woman will tell her hairdresser things she will not tell another human being, including her pastor, her best friend, and her mother, for the most part. So, good point. Slight segue. Upper arms. I've seen so many, you know, there's the stereotype of I walked into a door or whatever. I've done it. I'm clumsy. But I've never seen a door leave four bruises positioned right here. I'm not asking people to be CSI and criminal investigators. That's a completely separate course. But God gave us a lot of wisdom and a lot of intelligence. It's really, I shouldn't say it's real easy, but you could tell when what I'm seeing is not matching the story. Sudden changes in social habits, withdrawal, whether that's part of his tactics of isolation, whether it's she's hiding visible injuries, whether she just can't cope with social situations anymore, or whatever, withdrawal is a sign. You know, you've met for tea every Wednesday since the Johnson administration. Now all of a sudden she's, okay, I can't do that anymore. Maybe it's not abuse, but something has happened. People just do not change on a dime like that without stimulus. But that's a common sign. Changes in clothing choices. You know, the stereotype of I'm wearing the turtleneck and long sleeves in Florida in the summer when it's 119 degrees. What are we covering here? Or vice versa. She's dressing a lot more immodestly. Is he forcing her to dress that way because he wants her to be a sex object? That has happened. We've encountered that a lot. So is it just changes? That's the key thing to all of this. Something's like, whoa, something's changed. What's different? Is this a possibility? Increasing use of alcohol, tranquilizers, pain pills. We want to pretend that none of these things happen in our church. They do. The research Katya presented that Dr. Drum did, 20% of the women responded by starting to drink, to numb out, to cope. I guarantee you that, again, that number is low. I'm not saying that everyone who's prescribed Valium is being abused, but if all of a sudden she's chunking them down like Tic Tacs, and it's like, I don't think you were in a car wreck or have had any surgery where you need to be taking handfuls of Vicodin. You know, a lot of times that's self-medication. Let me numb out here. Never allowed to be alone. She might get ideas and haul off and leave if she's left alone. She might say something I don't want her to say. I have seen perpetrators follow their victims to the bathroom and stand outside the door. I mean, can't go into a ladies' room in public, which is why here's a tactic. How you can get information to women who are never allowed to be alone. Go to Office Depot or any office supply store. I'm not shilling for anyone. Get a little rack, put it on the inside of the ladies' room door. All of these brochures are available at AdventSource. Maybe she can't take one with her, but she can read it while she's in there. Have a Sharpie there. If she has to write down the National Domestic Violence Hotline on the inside of her shoe or the bottom of her shoe or wherever, it's our job. You know, working with victims is a lot like witnessing. It's our job to have information and to share it. We can't decide how people use said information. We can't make people use said information. But it's our responsibility to have the information available. So those are two good tactics to get around this of never being allowed, of being allowed to be alone.
In addition to the Sharpie and asking, a lot of women can't take paper out because the men will search her. There was a victim that actually wrote the hotline on the bottom of her foot.
Yeah.
But the Sharpie had to be there.
Yeah. So lots of creative things you can do to get information in the hands of victims. And in all these brochures, there's even more ideas. You can search the internet, a lot of the sites that are in your packets. Call me, email me. I'll be glad to start digging. I probably have it somewhere. Increasing frequency of tardiness or absence from work or church. Again, changes. Some people are habitually late, especially Adventists. So there's just some people who are always late. That's how they are. That's how they've always been. Okay, that's how they are. But now I'm suddenly tardy a lot. I'm absent a lot. You know, I've always been there. I'm reliable. What's changed in this person's life? Good story about work. It's a little long. Maybe you won't have the opportunity to do something this complex. Maybe you will. It was on 2020 or something like that, about 4 or 5 years ago. The story of this woman is she was being, verbally and physically abused. Her children were forced to hold the camcorder and record it while the husband for hours on end would do all of these things. Of course, the children are afraid. Not only are they afraid, they think it's normal. As if they've been incorporated into the abuse. So this woman, she had a job. Of course, she's scared to say anything, so she's not just talking to the world. And the manager, her manager, started noticing, wait a minute, she's late more often, she's calling in sick more often, what's up? And one day the manager, just walking by this lady's cubicle or whatever, heard her on the phone calling someone master. Because that's what she was forced to address him as. Not that she was eavesdropping, but hey, she's got an important piece of information there. Let's put those two together. Something's really broken in this woman's life. A manager asked her, is everything okay? Of course, yeah, everything's fine. So this manager started writing down, when was she late? When did she call in sick? Didn't berate her about it because the manager knew something's a little wrong there. Probably my coming down on her is not the best thing in the world. Eventually, after months and months of this, the victim did call the police. The victim did come forward. We are in the point of a trial. She had never called the police before, so there were no injuries. I can't remember the part of why those tapes weren't introduced. He had them hidden. He wasn't going to admit to that there were videotapes. The kids weren't going to admit to it. There was no corroborating evidence whatsoever. He said, she said, as they say. The natural bias is towards men. And, innocent until proven guilty is a valid legal principle. There was nothing to convict him with. Until this manager came forward with all of this information that directly matched the woman's story of when various things occurred. At that point, one of the children realized the game is coming apart. He's really guilty. He's an abuser. And we're able to produce the tapes. And that man is a guest of the state of New York for a very, very long time. Example of how we can put these clues together. Maybe we won't have a dramatic story like that, but we can still start to figure things out. Always look to the partner before speaking. I've seen victims, unfortunately, in churches. You cannot, when you say good morning, he's right there, and she looks to him before she even says, good morning, happy Sabbath. So conditioned that I do not have independent thought. Or if it's a more complex question like, would you like to come over to our house for fellowship lunch after church? She's not allowed to make decisions. She's going to look to him. Maybe it's a healthy thing. They just want, be sure he didn't have anything planned. Are we on the same page? But you could tell when someone's looking for, let's have a conversation and looking for permission. Defends and justifies the partner's inappropriate behavior. Someone says, when you guys were leaving church, I thought I saw him smack you in the back of the head. No, it wasn't that. He was just reaching around and, an accident, or he was just looking like this to back up and, whatever. He didn't really call me all these names. He's just had a bad day. You guys, I'm seeing recognition there, so I don't need to deal with that. Belittled in public by partner. If you love and respect someone, you do not belittle them in public. You just don't. There's obviously a broken sense of love. There's obviously disrespect when someone does this. How am I on time? 40 minutes. Okay. Story time. I met a woman named Brenda Klubine. She has now formed a domestic violence advocacy organization called Every 9 Seconds. You saw the statistic, a woman's battered every 15 seconds. There is research now that says that number is every 9 seconds. Now, whether that means it's occurring more frequently or we have a larger population, you know, whatever. That splitting hairs, the idea is it's way too much. She had married this guy. We're talking early 80s. She had married a gentleman. Great courtship. He was a great guy. All the stuff that we're thinking about perpetrators. He had a very great career. This is when companies spent money on giant Christmas parties and things like that. And they were at a Christmas party, and she laughed at another gentleman's joke across the table. And for the first time that any sign of abuse had happened, her husband says, "What, are you flirting with him? What, you hit on him?" And then, "Are you a whore? You're sleeping with him?" Just all this just completely tore her down. Do this. And, of course, she sat there and tried to sink into the floor the rest of the night. Was he having a bad day? No. Verbal abuse escalated. It got very violent. Remember, this is early 80s. Police departments had no idea what to do. It was still considered a family matter and all of that. Fairly small town. Perpetrator played golf with a lot of the law enforcement officers, so they're buddies. One call that she had to the police, she did call the police, and they would come out. They never really did anything. She had lost so much blood. The officer says, "I have no idea how you're not dead." What started with, "Let me belittle you in public," has turned really, really life-threatening. There was a point where she had fled. She had went to a hotel. He found her there. It's one of the smaller motels. You could see out over the whole parking lot. She sees he's there. "Oh, no, I've got to escape." Heads down to her car. She sees him. He then reaches into his trunk to get something. It wound up being a tire iron, but she knew that he owned guns. He was going to kill her. He was going to beat her to death in that parking lot. He later admitted to it. She hit him and killed him with the car. Did 25 years in prison. Now, do you think there would have been 20? He would have gotten 25 years if he had killed her? No, he'd gotten 5 to 7. Great movie called Sin by Silence that talks about how victims who defend themselves are really railroaded by the system. Great movie. Documentary style. And she got out. Heck, it's only been about 3 or 4 years now. She does a lot of speaking, public awareness engagements with her organization. Has a mild form of multiple sclerosis from all of the head trauma she suffered. She has to have someone basically accompany her in case she has a seizure at any given moment. And so, yeah, that's a gateway to a lot worse things. Depressing story. Let me make it happy for you. This is true. She is now remarried, happy, supportive, loving, respectful husband. You know who she's married to? The guy whose joke she laughed at. That started this whole cycle. 30 years later. So there can be happy endings. And that ties into the hope thing. It's real easy to dwell on the negative. I want us, when we go forth, to take these tools to point people to something positive. This kind of ties into the earlier ones. Frequent last-minute cancellations of appointments and meetings. Some people are just like that. My best friend in high school and college canceled pretty much 9 out of 10 things. The girl I dated in high school, same thing. That's how they are. But again, changes. What's going on? Is he not allowing her to go? Has she just been assaulted and just needs to hunker down? Changes in habits and social behavior. Instinct. Call it women's intuition. Call it the prompting of the Holy Spirit. Call it Donald Duck. Call it instinct. I don't care what you want to call it. When our little red flags go up and the hair stands up on the back of our neck, God is telling us there is something wrong with this situation. As my friend says, back home, little squirrels start doing backflips in your head. He has a weird sense of humor. However you want to. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. So whatever it is. So there are things we can pick up on and start to put pieces together. All right. Taking it to the next logical step, working with victims. Whether you're a women's ministries leader who's leading out a group of victims and survivors, that is one thing we've done in the Carolinas. There are a number of churches who have started support groups for survivors, created a safe place within the church, both for the community and the women who are members and any other survivors, men or children. A lot of great things happening within it now. Or it's your sister, whatever situation, you have either put the clues together or she has just reached out and said, I need help. Here's what's going on. However we got there, what do we do? I want every pastor in the world to hear this piece of the message. I'm getting there one at a time. What are the goals of working with victims? Another one of my two-word things. First, safety. That's why maybe leaving's not the best thing. Maintaining confidence, as Mac was talking about yesterday, and we're going to talk about that. I don't care who you trust. Once that cat's out of the bag, it will be all over the church and all over the community like that. Compromising safety. Next is empowerment. It's not our job to drag her out of the situation. Just as with witnessing, it's not our job to convict anyone of the truth. It is our job to be there to provide love, to provide support, to provide practical tools, and respect the fact that she's going to make her decision and she knows her situation better than we do. Whatever you know about 10% of the situation. Even if it's your sister, your daughter, or whatever, you know a tiny fraction. What the goal is not, and this is where pastors get frustrated, and leaders, and even secular professionals in the field. So many people leave this work because they do not grasp this concept. It is not our job to fix the situation. It is not our job to fix anyone. It is our job to provide support, tools, love, empowerment. Give her... provide the tools that he or she needs to be able to take control of their own life. Once we keep that in mind, everything else pretty much falls into place. What do we do? Listen, listen, listen. I added this phrase yesterday. Insert Mac's presentation here. Take that whole 2 hours and drop it right here. About being proactive, about empathy, about being non-judgmental, about being able to step back and have imagination and say, you know, I'm seeing this. Survivors are pretty susceptible to this. I went through this. Therefore, all DV fits in this box. Ability to imagination. I'm not going to rehash his presentation. Sorry, what was that? Yes. So all of those healthy communication and empowering skills and relationship skills, apply them all here. Yeah, we're getting the whole 8-hour production on that. That's a great place to start. Learn how to work with anyone or just associate with anyone. Daniel's like, I wasn't here for the presentation. Yeah. Express your concern for her safety. You know, I'm worried about you. This situation makes me nervous or whatever. Not spending too much time on us. I shouldn't say this situation makes me nervous. We don't want to talk about me. I'm concerned for your safety. I'm worried about you. I want what's best for you and those sort of things. Again, not telling her what that best is. Offer to help. But do not insist or demand. Because when we insist, when we demand, we are trying to take power and control. We are now an abuser. Because we're telling her, you do not have the right to make your own decisions and do your own thing. Here we are to save the day. Don't make assumptions. We talked about that. We all look at the world through our own experience and prism, but every human being is different. These are bullet points. These are ideas. They're not a checklist. Avoid "I told you so." Mothers and sisters are the worst for this. "I told you that Joe was no good. If you had listened to me before you got married, your mother and I, your sister and I, your brother and I told you not to marry this guy. Blah, 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 blah." I'm real sure she's not happy that she made that choice.
Best friends are bad.
Yeah, best friends are really bad. Because, hey, we're best friends. We've got that kind of communication. I could say anything I want. No. Because what have we done here? This is bigger than just hurting feelings and putting people down. "I told you so." You caused it by making a bad choice. You've just blamed the victim. What was Pearl Harbor doing in the middle of the Pacific Ocean? What were you doing in that part of town dressed like that? What were you doing making that choice? Belittled her choices, you've disrespected her, you've belittled her intelligence, her foresight. She's going to shut down at that moment. And understandably so. Pray. Pray for wisdom, guidance, and strength for both of you. I'm not saying tell her just go home and pray and everything will be okay. We don't do that with cancer victims in our church. "Well, you know what? You have cancer. This is God's will for your life. Go home and pray and everything will be fine." We do that to victims of violence all the time. Yeah, but yeah, prayer needs to be the central part of it. Make no mistake. I'm not belittling prayer. Prayer is the central part of everything, but that's not the entire solution. We anoint the cancer victim. We encourage her to get professional help, and everything else. And we support her and we love her. And when, we had a friend that just passed away of cancer a couple of months ago. There came a point where she decided no more chemo, no more treatment. You know what? This is it. People got upset. That was her choice. I'd like to think our church and the other support community did a good job of respecting that. So, learn about the resources available in your area. Share with her, again, not demanding she do anything. "You need to leave and go to shelter. You need to call this counselor. You need to do this. You need to do that." No. Here's options. Here are people who can help. "I'll be glad to drive you," or whatever, if and when you're ever ready. Stop. Maintain confidence unless she asks you otherwise. She may not feel comfortable going to the pastor. She may not feel comfortable calling the shelter for the first time or calling a hotline for the first time. If she asks you to do something, if it's not illegal or immoral, please do it. However, if there is suspicion of child abuse, most states have mandatory reporting laws. We can be held liable as individuals. We can be held liable as a church if we don't do that. Some states, anyone's a mandatory reporter. Some states, anyone that teaches children is. Again, that's where we need to go home and learn about our little piece of the world.
And this is what's dangerous for the church, because you'll have incidents of child abuse or child molestation in the church, and it's not reported. Mm-hmm. And if it ever goes to trial, then the church is held accountable. Mm-hmm. And if we haven't stepped up to the plate and done due diligence, then you're as much an accomplice as anything.
Yeah. What not to do. said this, I want to say it again. Do not tell her what to do. You're exercising power and control. You're re-victimizing. Why would she deal with this with you when she can go home and deal with it with a situation she understands better? Why doesn't she leave? Again, insist that she leave immediately. She knows her situation. There are professionals that do lethality assessments, that put together safety plans and all of those things. She's done it in her own head. She has her own survival skills. She has the knowledge, is it time to leave or time to go? Right now may be the worst possible time. A denigrate or abuser. It's real easy to say, yeah, Joe's a lowlife, this, that, and the other, and all of these things about Joe. One, it's not our job to make judgments of people's character. We, you know, X, Y, and Z behaviors are bad. But when we tear him down, one, we're just doing what Satan wants to do, getting us to hate people instead of hating sin. Oh, it is. It is very hard. And these are things that sound real great on a nice little slide, but you're right. That's where that prayer and wisdom and guidance comes in. All these pieces fit together.
You've got to remember, too, that you're denigrating her abuser. She may still love him.
Yep. I was on my way to that sentence. And if you attack someone I love, you've just created solidarity between us. You have actually pushed that relationship closer together. As you know, you attack Dana verbally or physically, I'm going to be right there and we're throwing down, probably even if she's wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just natural instinct when you have love. So, and again, you start to feed in, well, I know that he's all of these things. Why couldn't you figure it out before you got together with him? Even though you're not saying that, you're saying that. Insist that there is something she can or needs to do to fix him. Go home and try harder. Go home and try not to upset him. Go home and be sure you have the meal prepared properly. Don't let the kids watch too much television. It's not our job to fix. It is not her job to fix someone. Again, you're blaming her. If you would do all these things, there wouldn't be abuse.
It also reinstates her sense of restoring him or saving him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You've put a burden on her that is not a burden for any one of us to save anyone. Similar vein, telling her to try harder, don't do things that you know will upset him, putting the blame on her. This is why I want every human being alive to hear this message. We think we're helping. We come from a good place. But not knowing these things, we have no idea we're making the damage worse. Men in the room, brothers and fathers especially, offer to go and straighten out our abuser. I'll just take him behind the woodshed. Had someone say, well, not a problem if he doesn't come out from behind the woodshed. No, we're not condoning murder here. Here's the deal. Okay, someone I love, I don't have a sister or a daughter, but say I did have a sister, she was being abused, you know what? I am going to take him out behind the woodshed, literally and figuratively, and I'm going to give him a beating of his life. I will straighten him out. Two things have happened. One, I've just lost the moral high ground. I'm going to teach you not to hit by hitting. We've just reinforced to him, you know what? When someone doesn't do what you want them to do, you exercise power and control by hitting them. Let's not get down in the gutter here with people. And two, I lay a good old-fashioned whooping on somebody. Do you really think he's coming after me that night? No. He'll take it out on her. Or, I've had people say, people have come up to me either right there in the middle of the presentation or afterwards and say, well, when I did this in this small town, you know what? He stopped abusing her and he left town immediately. Okay, that person's no longer getting abused. Someone 20 miles down the road is. All you've done is kick the can down the curb. You really haven't accomplished anything in a real sense. Oh, pastors, pastors, pastors. Two words I want them to hear, or three. No couples counseling. Marriage counseling. You have a marriage problem. There is not a marriage problem. There is an abuse problem. There is a abuser. One person has power and control. That's what needs to be addressed. Because here's what happens. Joe, Sally, let's come into the pastor's office and let's discuss this. So, Sally, is Joe really doing X, Y, and Z? Sally's sitting there. What do I do? I certainly don't want to tell a lie. Anyway, it's definitely not to the pastor or anybody, or, you know, or a counselor or a judge or anybody else. Then again, if I say all this is going on, I know what's going to happen tonight. I know what's probably going to happen to the children tonight. A lot to put on someone who's already being abused. Sends the message that she deserves some of the blame. It takes two to have a marriage. If the marriage is broken, then both of you are the problem. Sally, you're half the problem. Yeah, Joe's got his basket of issues, but it's obvious that you do too. We need to fix the two of you. Now we've broken two things. Now we've violated two things. One, we put the blame on her. We've disempowered her. And two, we've decided we need to fix something. Two out of my three things. We blew up with this one thing. And safety. We blew that up too. Safety and empowerment, don't try to fix. Ignored all of those right there. Now, there's a whole book that I have of couples where there was abuse. And I believe it was Katya told a story yesterday where the marriage was able to be saved. The marriage was the fourth thing to address. Substance abuse has to be addressed on his part or the abuser's part. Any mental health issues. I'm not saying mental health justifies abuse, but sometimes there are mental health issues involved. And we have to get these two handled before we can get to better intervention, to start to reshape these cultural beliefs. Because if you're either not really in tune with reality with full cognitive ability, or you're high on something, you aren't going to comprehend things, you know, major life changes like that. Okay, if we make it through that third step, then if she's willing and he is, then maybe something that can happen here. I'm not going to kid you. That's very, 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 very rare. But it has happened. And God can do anything. Let's not put God in a box by making the decision of what's going to happen and what He's going to be able to accomplish. You know, God can do some great heart transplant. He's the great cardiologist. Again, may be useful after the perpetrator gets help. We're going to dig into some more of that this afternoon. If you are a victim, I don't think we have victims here, but carry this message to the world. Understand that this is not your fault. Anybody watching the video, this is not your fault. No one deserves to be abused, period, full stop. I will not take questions. Things victims can do. Work with someone knowledgeable in family abuse on a safety plan. I did one of these seminars about 8 months ago. A woman attended, a church member. She was a counselor. Really didn't understand the dynamics of domestic violence. She was working with a client who was getting ready to leave a situation. And this woman's smarter than I am. This woman, you know, has all these degrees and letters after her name and all of this. But she was also cognizant of the fact, family abuse is not my specialty. And she ran the safety plan by me. I made a couple of suggestions. I haven't followed up with her. This wasn't that long ago. There are suggestions we can make, but we need to not be afraid to reach out to professionals. I've heard from many Adventists, including pastors, we must only go to Adventist counselors and all of this. That would be great if there's one available. Most parts of the country, there's not one within 500 miles. We do not say, I will not go to this cardiologist or this cancer specialist or this audiologist or any other professional because they are not Seventh-day Adventist. We need to get past that barrier, and I need to add that to barriers for the church slide. Contact the National Domestic Violence or local shelter, the National Domestic Violence Hotline. That's where we come into play, having that information. Not telling them to call, but say, you know what? When the time is right, here's someone you can call. They will help with safety planning. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is the coolest thing in the world. I wish it didn't have to exist, but I'm grateful to God that it does. The number is in every single brochure there. It's all over the place. They offer services in it's either 124 or 142 languages. They can pull in translators. So another barrier, if you have language barriers, that's hard for us. Add that to the why doesn't she leave. If you speak an odd dialect that's spoken by about 1,000 people in the world, it's going to be real hard for you to get help. They can handle that. I was going to volunteer with them. I can get my master's degree with less class time. These people know their stuff. They can directly connect you to a local shelter. If you are just looking for advice, how can I help a friend? You can call, be anonymous. My sister's in San Diego. What's the number of a local shelter there? You can get that information. Awesome, awesome, awesome people. Did one of these seminars in upstate South Carolina. And one of the attendees, she's actually attended a few of them. She's actually a survivor that helps me out sometimes. She met a woman at a flea market and got to conversing with her, recognized those signs, got the conversation to a point where she knew found out the woman was being abused. She contacted me for confirmation. What should I do? I just reminded her, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline. They connected. The local shelters were full, which happens way too much. Found her a shelter in Georgia. This lady had the information, connected with the shelter. I mean, direct transfer, warm handoff, not please hold, dialing, okay, I've got Sally here or I have someone here. Really great stuff. Woman has found shelter. She is now becoming empowered and all of these things to start rebuilding her life. Little things we can do. So anyways, yeah, the National's hotline. If you know the local hotline, that's great. When I was at Safe Passage, a local shelter, we just had someone that called in every other night at 2 p.m. You knew if the phone, 2 a.m. You knew if the phone rang at 2 a.m., it was this woman. It was not time for her to leave. She was not ready to come to shelter. She just knew that it would be quiet at the shelter and the advocate would be able to just to talk to her and listen. Like what Max said, listening is 80% of this work. Victims start getting items together, social security cards, birth certificates, immunization records, an extra key, any money. Hard to get extra money. We had someone in Charlotte that spent 9 years saving a quarter a week to get the ability to leave. Had an advocate from Georgia say, you know, the only problem with what you're saying is here, if the perpetrator finds this quote-unquote stash, he's going to be like, what's going on here? All the natural disasters we had, a good cover story is I saw on TV that we need to be prepared in case of a hurricane, tornado, or whatever. As many hurricanes and tornadoes and earthquakes that are happening, it's a plausible story. And it's good to have this stuff together in case of such as that. Basically, anything you need to do to enroll your kids in school, rent a car, get a job. Establishing a safe word for your children. They know when they hear this word, they're supposed to go somewhere safe. Go outside, call the police, go to the neighbor's house, or whatever. I get some pushback on this. I don't want my children involved. They are involved. They know. Went to one training. There are now studies that show that when there's abuse in the home, those physical changes start happening in the child's mind at 6 months. Now, 6 months does not have any cognitive ability to realize what's broken, but they know what's broken. We tend to think kids are blind and dumb and ignorant, and they're just the opposite. They are just the exact opposite. They see and hear and absorb things that completely blow by us. Instruct the children how and when to call 911. What situation do you call? When do you not call? You know, if you, 10 minutes. If he's just being, I shouldn't say just being verbally abusive, but if this incident is verbal, maybe that's not time to call 911. If it gets physical, yeah. When I was in kindergarten, all we did was learn two things. How and when to call 911 and stop, drop, and roll. I think that was my entire, you know, if you're ever on fire, stop, drop, and roll. I spent the next 10 years sleeping facing the bedroom door because I thought I was going to burn to death. Some fire is going to come here again because all they talked about was if you catch on fire. I'm like, are people spontaneously combusting? What's going on here? But the point is, 911, we don't talk about that. We're so worried about getting arrested for false 911 calls, everything, that we're scared to call sometimes. Kids need to know, when have we crossed that boundary? Victims, when tensions rise, move out of the bathroom. Most bathroom windows you cannot crawl out of. Most bathrooms are covered in hard things like tile and granite and countertops. And I hate to be gruesome, but it's a whole lot easier to make someone bleed and wash them off right there in the tub or the shower to get rid of the evidence. It has happened. The garage, again, lots of concrete, tools, lots of hard things, lots of sharp things. Kitchen, obviously you've got knives. Any room without an exterior door. Basically, when things start rising, get to some place as safe as possible. And Mac talked about that. The living room's usually good. There's usually three ways to get out, and pillows don't hurt as much as pipe wrenches. Yes, that's the example he used. And remembering that help is available when you are ready. I mean, help's always available, but do not feel like it's being thrust upon you until you are ready. Yeah. So remind victims of this, you know, whether it's me, whether it's someone else, whether it's the hotline, these things are available. It sounds real easy to tell a victim. This is the part that breaks my heart. I've heard from so many people, you know, not every shelter, there's good shelters and bad shelters. There are shelters staffed by people who really know their stuff, who have a caring heart. There are shelters staffed by you. Hey, here's the person who's available. Really not versed in the dynamics of domestic violence. May not have those great conversational empathy skills that Mac talked about. Shelters are often full. Very often. City of Charlotte turns away 2,000 victims a year. It's just, it's tough. But as a friend, as a church worker, you can be there every step of the way and help navigate this. So I would love to say, call the hotline and your life will be magically cured. It's not. It's a long, hard road, which is why there needs to be a support structure, which is why our church needs to be equipped to be that support structure. I have a lot of ideas of how to get there. That's part of my conclusion. You have these in your packet, resources, the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. A lot of good information. They do come from a very leftist feminist perspective, so forget the political disagreements. But as far as nuts and bolts and resources, there's a lot there. National Network to End Domestic Violence, a lot of good information there. This organization kind of focuses on social change. Let's turn the world on its head. This organization actually split off from them in the early 80s, mid 80s. Let's work within the system, really things like that. So it's just a philosophical difference. And then, of course, there's the hotline. Shelter, a lot of people are. Yeah, I grew up in Chesapeake, Virginia, right next to Virginia Beach, hurricane land. And hurricanes would come. You see shelters on TV in your high school gyms. There's no power, so it's like 95 degrees humidity. There's babies crying. There's people lined up on cots. There's dog feces all over the place. And we saw the pictures of the Superdome after Katrina. When we think emergency shelter, that's what we think. And I had no idea what I was about to walk into the first time I saw a shelter. Again, some are better than others. There's a lot of great ones out there. Most of them, when they have the resources, try to make it feel like a second home, not here's an institution. You're in a hospital. It's cold and white, and usually have a living area. This is an actual shelter. It's in Florida. This is why I'm working on, I'm not sure where in Florida. That's why I'm working on my master's degree, because I want to work there. That's nicer than any house I've ever been in that I didn't have to pay to tour. So, yeah, there are nice ones. Don't get excited and promise that to anyone. Kitchen, playrooms, again, trying to make things as natural as possible. Kitchen, different shelters do that differently. Stay in shelter I worked at. 5 minutes, good, because I've got about two more slides. Shelter I worked at, women were paired up every night, okay? You two, here's state of South Carolina, regulated the ingredients because you were serving kids to be sure they get a balanced meal and all that. Take these ingredients and make magic happen. It's cool. We got interaction. That worked out well. Some are worried about liability and things. They do not allow the residents to cook, and someone comes in. The shelter in Gaston County where I do batterer work, church groups, local organizations bring in the meal. There's usually about 15, 20 women and children there at any given time. Great outreach opportunity right there. If your local shelter operates in that manner, you go in and share. And because another thing that End It Now is so cool with, it's a great witnessing opportunity. Not telling people if you want help, you have to join our religion and all of that. But when we did the signature campaign that was going on, you start collecting signatures and, collecting signatures for End It Now, Deliver the UN, we're against violence against women. What's an End It Now? You know, you describe violence against women. Sponsored by the Seventh-day Adventist Church. What's a Seventh-day Adventist Church? You didn't force yourself upon them. They asked. A Christian denomination, and we do this because we love all of God's people and we want to end the suffering. Great outreach opportunity. Same thing. We did three presentations in South Carolina in three different counties that were covered by the same DV organization. They were just so impressed with the church and the love and everything else that we've shown. Very positive impression of not only our church, but of Jesus and how he changes our hearts to a heart of love and a heart of service. Love it now. And there are a lot of misconceptions. As someone who works in the secular world, frankly, the program I go to in Denver, very far to the left sociopolitically. Obviously, it's Seventh-day Adventist Church, and, you know, sociopolitically pretty conservative, which is good. There's a giant gap. There's a lot of stereotypes. If you're in the DV field, you're an angry lesbian who wants to be a man. Not sure how that works for me. Yeah, I get angry sometimes, but I'm already a man, which makes the other part genetically impossible. And so we have these misconceptions that they're anti-religion, they're anti-God. Are there some people like that? Yeah. There's a lot of Christians in the movement on the other side of the wall, a lot of good people. And a lot of secular people in this movement see Christians as, very stereotypical, very rigid, wives submit to your husbands, and very misogynist and very anti-woman and promoting abuse and condoning it. Are there some like that? Yeah, the vast majority are not. So that's kind of a role I play in this movement, is trying to bridge the gap. There are things we bring to the table. There are things that they bring to the table. If we'd stop competing and start working together, we can make the social change necessary to end the pandemic of domestic violence. Get out of sermon mode. Launched into sermon mode. Bedrooms, usually bunk beds just to maximize space. Families are kept together. If you're single, you'd be paired up with people. Lunchtime. One thought I want to leave you with before we go. When I got in this movement, it was interviewing the director of that shelter. She is also a board member of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And she said, I could see God is talking to you, Chris. Just understand you can't change the world. True. I could change the world for one person. So can you. And so can you. And so can you. And if we all change the world for one person, yeah, we really can change the world together. Thank you. That's the end of this piece. We've got lunch. We're coming back at 2:30. Katya is going to talk about the resilience of victims. Again, breaking down the idea that they're all helpless and need us to save them and all of that. people are very strong. Sometimes people just need tools to move forward. And then I'm going to talk about working with perpetrators, especially within the church. Lots of ideas that I have for all levels of the church, just to get your ideas going, and then a bit of a conclusion, and then I have prayer that God will use all of us to indeed change the world for one person.
This media was produced by Audioverse for the NAD Health Summit. If you would like to learn more about the NAD Health Summit, please visit www.nadhealthsummit.com. Or if you would like to listen to more free online sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.